519-763-3000. That's the Guelph Dance March Break Arts Explosion Camp from March 14th to the 18th. Visit guelphdance.ca for pricing and more information.
Hey there, Guelph. Want to catch up on the latest and greatest musical happenings right here in the Royal City? Tune in to Home Cookin', a brand new show featuring live recordings from around town, studio albums, and basement demos exclusively from local artists. If it's from Guelph, made in Guelph, or happening in Guelph, you'll hear it here on Home Cookin', Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on 93.3 CFRU.
The famously mischievous Tomcat in a Top Hat comes to life in this theatrical interpretation of the Dr. Seuss classic, taking place at the River Run Center, 35 Woolwich Street, a physically accessible location.
We looked!
And we saw him!
The Cat in the Hat!
The Cat in the Hat, Saturday, February 20th at 2 p.m., part of the Guelph Mercury Family Series. Tickets are on sale now at the River Run box office. Call 519-763-3000 or visit riverrun.ca.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Now, let us begin with the modern period of, I guess we could start with 1956 for our generation. This was the beginning of the rise of Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King decided that in Montgomery, Alabama, Black people had to pay the same prices on the buses as did white people, but we had to sit in the back. And we could only sit in the back if every available seat was taken by a white person. If a white person was standing, a black person could not sit. So Dr. King and his associates got together and said, "This is inhuman. We will boycott your bus system." Now understand what a boycott is. A boycott is a passive act. It is the most passive political act that anyone can commit, a boycott. Because what the boycott was doing was simply saying, "We will not ride your buses." No sort of antagonism. He was not even verbally violent. He was peaceful. Dr. King's policy was that nonviolence would achieve the gains for black people in the United States. His major assumption was that if you are nonviolent, if you suffer, your opponent will see your suffering and will be moved to change his heart. That's very good. He only made one fallacious assumption. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none. Has none.
The devil's devil has a couple fools. My culture screwed, cause this word is misconstrued. Small countries exempt from food, cause leaders have different views. You choose.
What mean the world to me is being free. Live and let live and just let it be.
Let it be.
Love, peace, and harmony. One universal family. One God, one aim, and one destiny.
Oh yeah. Imagine life without a choice at all. Giving a vote without a voice at all. These be the problems that we face. I'm talking poverty and race, but no matter what the case, we gotta
hold on to this feeling. Freedom, freedom. That hold on to this feeling. Freedom, freedom.
Yo, I'm the first candidate to hate. Had to beat on the drum to communicate. For what was to come to those who were hung, they would decapitate the tongue if you would mention the word
freedom.
Got people screaming, free Bonilla Jamal. But two out of three of y'all will probably be at the mall. I'm heated with y'all, the defeated will fall. Incomplete and unsolved when the word freedom's involved.
Yo, my forefathers hung in trees to be free.
Rest in peace.
Got rid of slavery, but still kept the penitentiary. And now freedom got a shotgun and shells with your name. Release the hot ones and let freedom ring.
I'm a former boat prisoner, Hollywood visitor. Dance for cats, segregated on wax. My color got me handy. Cap, Anus, and Andy. For the freedom, they just won't hand me.
Hold on to this feeling.
So true, and they've been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song. Cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true, and they've been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Jurassic 5 with Freedom. And before that, we had Stokely Carmichael of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense with his analysis of Dr. Martin Luther King and his policy of passive boycotts. Now, of course, we are celebrating Black History Month here on Back in the USSR. One of the things I've talked about many, many times on this show, really throughout the year, not just as part of Black History Month, but like the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense and the Black Power Movement in general, has been a major topic on this show. It's something I've talked about many, many times. And I really want to start the show by talking a little bit more about, because of course in the last few weeks we've talked about like some pretty major figures in the struggle for black liberation in the United States. You know, we talked about Paul Robeson, we talked about James Baldwin, we talked about W.E.B. Du Bois. Tonight, I want to at least start the show by talking about Huey P. Newton, one of the co-founders of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And I want to introduce him. I'm going to play, in just a little while, I'm going to play an interview that was done with him by James Baldwin, by James Baldwin himself, like interviewing Huey P. Newton. But I want to begin by reading from his book. He wrote a book called Revolutionary Suicide in the 1970s, and this is the introduction from his book. It's called Revolutionary Suicide, The Way of Liberation. It's a manifesto. And he says, for 22 months in the California men's colony at San Luis Obispo, after my first trial for the death of Patrolman John Frey, I was almost continually in solitary confinement. There, in a 4x6 cell, except for books and papers relating to my case, I was allowed no reading material. Despite the rigid enforcement of this rule, inmates sometimes slipped magazines under my door when the guards were not looking. One that reached me was the May 1970 issue of Ebony Magazine. It contained an article written by Lacey Banco summarizing the work of Dr. Herbert Hendon, who had done a comparative study on suicide among black people in the major American cities. Dr. Hendon found that the suicide rate among black men between the ages of 19 and 35 had doubled in the past 10 to 15 years, surpassing the rate for whites in the same age range. The article had, and still has, a profound effect on me. I have thought long and hard about its implications. The Ebony article brought to mind Durkheim's classic study, Suicide, a book I had read earlier while studying sociology at Oakland City College. To Durkheim, all types of suicide are related to social conditions. He maintains that the primary cause of suicide is not individual temperament, but forces in the social environment. In other words, suicide is caused primarily by external factors, not internal ones. As I thought about the conditions of black people and about Dr. Hendon's study, I began to develop Durkheim's analysis and apply it to the black experience in the United States. This eventually led to the concept of revolutionary suicide. To understand revolutionary suicide, it is first necessary to have an idea of reactionary suicide, for the two are very different. Dr. Hendon was describing reactionary suicide, the reaction of a man who takes his own life in response to social conditions that overwhelm him and condemn him to helplessness. The young black man in his study had been deprived of human dignity, crushed by oppressive forces, and denied their right to live as proud and free human beings. The section in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment provides a good analogy. One of the characters, Marmeladov, a very poor man, argues that poverty is not a vice. In poverty, he says, a man can attain the innate nobility of soul that is not possible in beggary. For while society may drive the poor man out with a stick, the beggar will be swept out with a broom. Why? Because the beggar is totally demeaned, his dignity lost. Finally bereft of self-respect, immobilized by fear and despair, he sinks into self-murder. This is reactionary suicide. Connected to reactionary suicide, although even more painful and degrading, is a spiritual death that has been the experience of millions of black people in the United States. This death is found everywhere today in the black community. Its victims have ceased to fight the forms of oppression that drink their blood. The common attitude has long been, what's the use? If a man rises up against a power as great as the United States, he will not survive. Believing this, many blacks have been driven to a death of the spirit rather than of the flesh, lapsing into quiet lives of quiet desperation. Yet all the while, in the heart of every black, there is a hope that life will somehow change in the future. I do not think that life will change for the better without an assault on the establishment, the power structure, based on the economic infrastructure propped up and reinforced by the media and all the secondary educational and cultural institutions, which goes on exploiting the wretched of the earth. This belief lies at the heart of the concept of revolutionary suicide. Thus, it is better to oppose the forces that would drive me to self-murder than to endure them. Although I risk the likelihood of death, there is at least the possibility, if not the probability, of changing intolerable conditions. This possibility is important because much in the human existence is based upon hope without any real understanding of the odds. Indeed, we are all, black and white alike, ill in the same way, mortally ill. But before we die, how shall we live? I say with hope and dignity, and if premature death is the result, that death has a meaning reactionary suicide can never have. It is the price of self-respect. Revolutionary suicide does not mean that I and my comrades have a death wish. It means just the opposite. We have such a strong desire to live with hope and human dignity that existence without them is impossible. When reactionary forces crush us, we must move against those forces even at the risk of death. We will have to be driven out with a stick. Che Guevara said that to a revolutionary, death is the reality and victory the dream. Because the revolutionary lives so dangerously, his survival is a miracle. Bakunin, who spoke for the most militant wing of the First International, made a similar statement in his Revolutionary Catechism. To him, the first lesson a revolutionary must learn is that he is a doomed man. Unless he understands this, he does not grasp the essential meaning of his life. When Fidel Castro and his small band were in Mexico preparing for the Cuban Revolution, many of the comrades had little understanding of Bakunin's rule. A few hours before they set sail, Fidel went from man to man asking who should be notified in case of death. Only then did the deadly seriousness of the revolution hit home. Their struggle was no longer romantic. The scene had been exciting and animated, but when the simple, overwhelming question of death arose, nearly everyone fell silent. Many so-called revolutionaries in this country, black and white, are not prepared to accept this reality. The Black Panthers are not suicidal, neither do we romanticize the consequences of revolution in our lifetime. Other so-called revolutionaries cling to an illusion that they might have revolution and die of old age. That cannot be. I do not expect to live through our revolution, and most serious comrades probably share my realism. Therefore, the expression revolution in our lifetime means something different to me than it does to other people who use it. I think the revolution will grow in my lifetime, but I do not expect to enjoy its fruits. That would be a contradiction. The reality will be grimmer. I have no doubt that the revolution will triumph. The people of the world will prevail, seize power, seize the means of production, wipe out racism, capitalism, reactionary intercommunalism, and reactionary suicide. The people will win a new world. Yet when I think of individuals in the revolution, I cannot predict their survival. Revolutionaries must accept this fact, especially the Black revolutionaries in America, whose lives are in constant danger from the evils of a colonial society. Considering how we must live, it is not hard to accept the concept of revolutionary suicide. In this, we are different from white radicals, for they are not faced with genocide. The greater, more immediate problem is the survival of the entire world. If the world does not change, all its people will be threatened by the greed, exploitation, and violence of the power structure in the American Empire. The handwriting is on the wall. The United States is jeopardizing its own existence and the existence of all humanity. If Americans knew the disasters that lay ahead, they would transform this society tomorrow for their own preservation. The Black Panther Party is in the vanguard of the revolution that seeks to relieve this country of its crushing burden of guilt. We are determined to establish true equality and the means of creative work. Some see our struggle as a symbol of the trend towards suicide among blacks. Scholars and academics in particular have been quick to make this accusation. They fail to perceive differences. Jumping off a bridge is not the same as moving to wipe out the overwhelming force of an oppressive army. When scholars call our actions suicidal, they should be logically consistent and describe all historical revolutionary movements in the same way. Thus, the American colonists, the French of the late 18th century, the Russians of 1917, the Jews of Warsaw, the Cubans, the NLF, the North Vietnamese, any people who struggle against a brutal and powerful force are suicidal. Also, if the Black Panthers symbolize the suicidal trend amongst blacks, then the whole Third World is suicidal, because the Third World fully intends to resist and overcome the ruling class of the United States. If scholars wish to carry their analysis further, they must come to terms with that 4/5 of the world, which is bent on wiping out the power of the empire. In those terms, the Third World would be transformed from suicidal to homicidal, although homicide is the unlawful taking of life, and the Third World is involved only in defense. Is the coin then turned? Is the government of the United States suicidal? I think so. With this redefinition, the term revolutionary suicide is not as simplistic as it might seem initially. In coining the phrase, I took two knowns and combined them to make an unknown. The neoteric phrase in which the word revolutionary transforms the word suicide into an idea that is that has different dimensions and meanings applicable to a new and complex situation. My prison experience is a good example of revolutionary suicide in action, for prison is the microcosm of the outside world. From the beginning of my sentence, I defied the authorities by refusing to cooperate. As a result, I was confined to lockup, a solitary cell. As the months passed, and I remained steadfast, they came to regard my behavior as suicidal. I was told that I would crack and break under the strain. I did not break, nor did I retreat from my position. I grew strong. If I had submitted to their exploitation and done their will, it would have killed my spirit and condemned me to a living death. To cooperate in prison meant reactionary suicide to me. While solitary confinement can be physically and mentally destructive, my actions were taken with an understanding of the risk. I had to suffer through a certain situation, and by doing so, my resistance told them that I had rejected all they stood for. even though my struggle might have harmed my health, even killed me, I looked upon it as a way of raising the consciousness of the other inmates, as a contribution to the ongoing revolution. Only resistance can destroy the pressures that cause reactionary suicide. The concept of revolutionary suicide is not defeatist or fatalistic. On the contrary, it conveys an awareness of the reality in combination with the possibility of hope. Reality, because the revolutionary must always be prepared to face death, and hope, because it symbolizes a resolute determination to bring about change. Above all, it demands that the revolutionary see his death and his life as one piece. Chairman Mao says that death comes to all of us, but it varies in its significance. To die for the reactionary is lighter than a feather. To die for the revolution is heavier than Mount Tai. That's Huey P. Newton, his introduction to his book, Revolutionary Suicide. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
They claim we're brought us from the bottom of hell. Cause the blackest back in is bound to sell. Picture us cooling out on the 4th of July. And if you heard we were celebrating, that's a worldwide lie. Yo, Chuck, the Fat Data Rules, man, trying to pull a 226 on you, G. Yo, man, show them what you got. Show them what you got.
This style seems wild. Wait before you treat me like a stepchild. Let me tell you why they got me on file. Cause I give you what you lack. Come right in, exact. I said it's the status, so I care where you're at. Black, in that home, I got a call from Tony Rome. The FBI was tapping my telephone. I never live alone, I never walk alone. My posse's always ready and they waiting in my zone. Although I live the life that of a resident, but I've been knowing the scheme that of a president. Tapping my phone, whose crew's abused? I stand accused of doing harm, cause I'm louder than a bomb. A rock hard trooper to the bone, the bone, the bone. Full grown, consider me stone. Once again, and I say it for you to know. The trooper's always ready. I am Geronimo, your CIA, your CIA king. Both King and X, they got rid of both. A story untold, true but unknown. Possess a grip, no.
So I ain't no toast.
And not the bragging, I'm boasting. And plus, it ain't no secret why they're tapping my phone. Although I can't keep it a secret, so I decided to kick it, yo. And yes, it weighs a ton. I say it once again. I'm called an enemy. I'll never be afraid of those with closed minds. And know that I'm rapping. The way that I rap it is making them tapping, yeah. Never serving them well, cause I'm an untime. It's no secret at all, cause I'm louder than a bomb. Taking my code in my bucket, cause they're bugging my phone for information. No telling, no selling, that power building the nation. So, joining the set, stop, point blank, target every brother's inside. So, least not you forget, no. Taking the blame is not a waste. Here it tastes a bit of a song, so you can never be wrong. Just a bit of advice, so we be paying a price. Cause every brother man's life is like swinging a dice, right? Here it is once again. Fifth is the brother, the Terminator, the color. Going on, leave alone the groom. Get it straight in 88. Demonstrate the posse always ready. 98 and 98. My posse come quick because my posse got velocity. Tapping my phone, never leave me alone. I'm even lethal when I'm unarmed. Cause I'm louder than a bomb.
Tell me you laughing.
You can come and get some of this. I teach and speak, so when it's focused, no joke. No voice of choice, the place shakes with bass. Call one for the treble, the rhythm is the rebel. Here's a funky rhyme that they're tapping on. Just thinking I'm breaking the beats I'm rapping on. CIA, FBI, all they tell us is lies. When I say it, they get alarmed. Cause I'm louder than a bomb, bomb.
You think, the Blacks are ready for full-scale revolution in America.
At this time, it's a prelude to the revolution.
This interview with Huey Newton, Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party, took place in the Oakland jail, where he is awaiting trial for what he terms self-defense. The ruins of the house you will see is what was left after the Oakland police surrounded it and shot it up in an effort to clean out the Black Panther's leaders. 17-year-old Bobby Hutton, treasurer of the Black Panther Party, was killed, and Eldridge Cleaver, Minister of Communications, was wounded. The house has since become a symbol for young people.
Here in America, we see that in the colony, the black people are poor. They own no vested interest, really, in the industry. And what happens is our political representatives in the past have been only pawns for their white political colleagues who do have power. And they depend upon these political colleagues to keep them in office, and they depend upon their political colleagues to justify their actions. The Black Panther Party says that because we don't have these other things as far as economically, then we must develop still a power base. Historically, when revolts occur, there's an indication that something is going to happen, and that it seems to be a prelude to the actual revolution, where things will be changed. So I think we're moving towards this revolution. There are some alternatives, and the only alternative would be to first withdraw the troops from our many black communities, and secondly, that we demand control of the institutions within our community. These are first steps. So it's clear in my mind through the current events that black people are thinking in these terms, even though most people are not very articulate, that you always have the articulate minority. And the job of this articulate minority is to express the desires in some coherent fashion of the majority of the people.
Do you think that the white right wing is using the black militants to full-scale war against the black people in America?
Well, as I see it, the full-scale war against us has been going on for some 400 years.
I mean, completely, but, like, wipe us out, the black people out. I mean, that they can open the concentration camp, they can have justification of the blacking off the black ghetto, wiring it off, put troops around it. Do you think the right wing agitating the Black Panther and any other black militant group in that direction?
I don't really think that whether they're agitating or not, I won't say that they're not. But what they're putting themselves in for is quite a different thing. You see, in other words, as far as black people being slaughtered, we're slaughtered every day, and historically, 50 million black people were killed on the Middle Passage alone, according to Melvin J. Herskovich. And this was an act of genocide, which is not talked about, and that the only thing people talk about is the plight of the Jews, where 6 million were killed. And when I state that 50 million black people were killed, just bring them to this country, no one understands this. But what I'm saying is that our real danger is not the Birchites or the Minutemen or some other fanatics. That our danger is really the people who wear the uniform of the establishment, dressed in the clothes of the military or the police department. They're strong enough to wipe us out not wipe us out. They're strong enough to inflict great harm upon the community. And this thing about the fanatics going around agitating, I don't think it will have a great consequence to the black community. The killing of little Bobby Hutton, our treasurer, was a matter of attempting to wipe out the leadership of the Panther, along with getting rid of Eldridge Cleaver because of his book, Soul on Ice, that reveals many things about the corruption of the penal system. Not only the Black Panther Party, black people in general are in danger. As you would note, that in the community where the police ambushed the Panthers, that the police fired upon the community in general. They fired in people's homes where there might have been women and children. Matter of fact, I understand that a child was almost killed, and that it was a continuation of the traditional tactics, not only of the Oakland Police Department, but the police throughout the country. And an immediate end will have to be put to this, and I think that what's happening now, that the Black Panther Party is merely speeding up time. As we know that whenever a man becomes frantic and strikes wildly, that he's becoming very weak. He's striking now everyone in the world, and we know that he won't be able to engage the whole colored world into a war, and also fight a civil war here with the revolutionary people of America.
I want to know the trend of young people in the colleges, not only black young people, but also white young people is coming forward for the revolution. In fact, there's a thing on the campus, even in Oakland here, where young people march around the jail and said, "Let here we go." You think it's a young revolution is coming? That will be more and more coming.
Yes. Now the white intellectuals are responding to the liberation cry of the colony. And one of the reasons is that the intellectuals are very conscious of the political situation and seemingly very sensitive, and they're attempting to avoid a suicide of the United States. They see very well and very clearly that the United States is about to commit a suicide, because any time that you take the bread and the livelihood away from a people or an individual, you're automatically threatening your own life, because that person then will rise up against you and possibly to do you bodily harm, because he's demanding life and he cannot live without bread. The intellectual sees this, and he's attempting to curtail it. And he sees that there has to be some modification or a revolution in the country to replace the old racist institutions.
So what you're saying here is it's not a race war, say, because it's understood now what's happening is a race war. Can you explain that
better? The first place, the intellectuals make up a small percentage of the general population, and it's a small percentage of whites who are revolutionary white people, and that it's very difficult to divide the race issue from the economical struggle. Number one, because white America is by and large a racist people. And not only to black people in the colony here, but to people of color all over the world. And I think that the on one side, as far as black people are concerned, it's not a race issue. It's simply an economical struggle and a cultural struggle. But the difference between it's a conflict between the culture of the white American middle class and the black lower class, and that but the black people don't hate white people because they're white. They hate white people because they inflict racism upon them, and they're exploiting us.
Tell me, Huey, what can the militant group or the revolutionary group do to protect their leaders? What can we get through to the people that when like Hutton went down and Malcolm got killed, Martin Luther King got killed, you're in jail, Cleaver is in jail. What you know, how can we impose on them the importance that it's just as important as when Kennedy got shot? The loss is that great. What are you doing toward?
The first thing that we have to realize that the leaders don't have any strength, really. That the vanguard group of the revolution doesn't have strength other than the strength of the people. The black community should be the protector of its leaders. And that the black community should be a haven for the leaders and a stronghold for protection. At this point, black people are afraid of the tremendous power that the races are flexing, and it's a matter of overestimation of the power that race of America has, and that it's an underestimation of our own strength. But a time will come when black people will rise up like a mighty storm or hurricane, sweeping all evil gentry and corrupt officials into their graves. And nothing will be able to hold this force back because it will be so swift. And at this point, the masses will have great faith in the vanguard and the leadership, and that they will protect the leadership. In every country where revolution has occurred, the vanguard has always suffered in the early days because of a lack of trust of the people. And it's a matter of overestimating the enemy. I'm thinking of Cuba now, and Bolivia in particular, where the peasants supported Che Guevara and the guerrillas, but at the same time, Che was very aware of the fact that the villagers might give him up at any moment simply because of the fear and the strength of the Bolivian regular army with the help of the CIA. But the same thing happened in Cuba. But it's as because the guerrilla lived for a length of time in Cuba to develop certain strongholds, then the people became more secure and had more faith in the vanguard group. And I think that this will happen in this country, and I think that it's even happening now because the community is becoming more and more receptive to the problems and the demands that the vanguard group makes upon the community.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, we're playing an interview with Huey P. Newton of the Black Panther Party by James Baldwin. So please stay tuned. Back in the USSR.
Motivate you? What makes you take up such a tremendous, I would say, burden? Because it's so tremendous, because you're giving your life for it. So I would like you to explain to me.
Well, from a very early age, with my association with people who were politically inclined, the first group was a black nationalist group. I was at the age of about 16 or 17. They sort of guided me into an awareness of the plight of black people in America and people of color all over the world. And from that age on, I've been involved with political movements. And that, of course, I've experienced racism. Just being black here in America, one will necessarily experience exploitation and be affected by racism. I started to handle the question and strive for a solution to it. And up until this time, I think with this awareness, one becomes more and more sensitive. And as one realizes the magnitude of the plight, one understands that people cannot live under this system or any capitalistic system because it excludes most of the people, and just a very small circle enjoy the fruits of the labor of the many. So working from this premise, that I found it necessary to pass this consciousness on to other people. And the black man in general, ever since he's been here in America, has strived towards this freedom. Denmark Vesey and Nat the Prophet Turner were men who were speaking of freedom.
Tell me, have you come into a relationship between the people that you work with? You started off with like Hutton and Cleaver, you know, and all the other Panthers that are in jail or indicted now. Or tell me the relationship. Could you explain that to me? How you meet and you know, briefly, and you know what makes them change and so forth.
Well, it's a matter of as far as the general membership of the Panthers, pointing out to them the pitfalls of the institutions here in America. Eldridge Cleaver, who's the Minister of Information of the party, and Bobby Seale, who's the chairman, and Bobby Hutton, who's the treasurer, were very close to me, are very close. Bobby was just as a brother. We view each other with a great love and a great understanding, and that we try to extend this to the general black population and also people, oppressed people all over the world. And I think that we differ from some other groups simply because we understand the system better than most groups understand the system. And with this realization, we attempted to form a strong political base based in the community with the only strength that we have, and that's the strength of a potentially destructive force if we don't get freedom.
What is there about this system that creates and breeds racism?
I think that racism is in this country starts out as a very historical thing. It was probably stimulated through the greed for profit. Of course, that black people were brought here in chains as slaves to for the wealth of the enslaver, who was the European. And the reasons for white people choosing black people from south of Sahara was probably because of some because of the twisted mind of the European. And I think this stems into the religious situation, that the European was unfortunate for some reason and acclaimed one God, or absolutism, what we call it. He worshipped one God, and this God was all good, absolutely good, all powerful, and this God, of course, didn't have the animal drive that the human being has. Because the European identified with this one God, then he was put in a situation of rejecting himself. Let me finish this. He rejected, for instance, his sex drive. If he did anything that deviated from the code of God, then he was automatically a witch or something subhuman. Then when he contacted the African, especially south of Sahara, where we had dualism, and our God had two or more heads, that you ran into a situation where the African could accept himself as a human being, accept his sex drives, and he didn't have to project his humanism to anyone else. And the European projected all of his evilness that he himself had to, or so-called evilness, really was just human drives, to the African. And so it was a combination, what I'm attempting to explain, of not only economic exploitation, but also racism. And then coming to this country because it was so profitable for the European, or the American in this case, to work the slave, that this racism became ingrained, and many white people don't understand it now.
Let me say this. I have watched a beautiful relationship between you and Gary that worked beautifully. And when people talking about Black Panther and racism, the relationship here between you and your lawyer, who is white, I haven't seen any racism in this case. What makes the difference here?
Well, if you were familiar with Panthers in general, you wouldn't see any racism either. That we're not racist. We believe that the solution to the problem here in America is not the goal is not racism, but the goal is freedom. And that the Black Panther Party is willing to work with any revolutionary people, and that it's not a color thing. That the Black Panther Party and black people in general, I believe, the bulk of us are colorblind, that it's a matter of freedom, a matter of being free from the exploiter, nothing more, nothing less. The Black Panther Party is first a political party, and that we've analyzed the political situation here in America, and we see that black people are colonized people. And that we have to, if we're going to find an answer for our problem, which is a problem of liberation, that black people are in a state of slavery and we must be liberated from the mother country. And the first steps that we'll have to take towards liberation is control of our community. If we have no control of the destiny of the institutions within our community, then we have no guarantee of any other political right. And as we analyze history, we see that according to some historians, John O. Franklin, for one, and also E.B. Du Bois, says that the reason that black Reconstruction failed was because of a lack of political and economical and military power. And so the Black Panther Party is attempting to develop this political power. And one of the chief things that happened after the Civil War was the disarmament of black people by Lincoln. And Lincoln made certain statements to the effect that he didn't want black people to form guerrilla groups so that they could get true liberation. So this is why he disarmed them. We were promised land, which was never given by the Free Man's Bureau, 40 acres and 2 mules, according to Du Bois. All we got after the Emancipation Proclamation and Black Reconstruction was some black representatives and in the government. What was peculiar about these black politicians was that, in fact, they didn't represent a power force. Usually in the political arena, a political representative represents a power group, whether it's economical power or feudal power, commonly called land power, or even a military might. We notice that if one cannot protect his land, then he doesn't really have control of it. We notice that this government, after it makes a political decision, it always has its force to back up that political decision, and in the dress of the military or their police force.
So what you're doing is forming a political program then?
Yes, we do have a political program.
Could you just outline this briefly, what your political program?
Well, our political program is to secure the ability to determine the destiny of our community. It's to ensure our community of decent housing. We want full employment for our people with a high standard. of living that will provide a high standard of living, because this is the richest country in the world, and we can't see any reason why that this government cannot employ all of its people.
Say, for instance, talking about the program on employment and full employment, suppose the white community decide, okay, today that it's not going to hire any black because of the revolutionary, where would you say would be the basic starting of the black man? Where would you start from then? What would you do?
If white people were to stop hiring black people?
Yes.
Yeah, well, this is approximately the situation now, that a large percentage of black people are unemployed, and we're in the poverty zone, that our people suffer from malnutrition, that we suffer from poor education due to a lack of economical strength. And where we would start from is to modify the whole economical system. We also demand a plebiscite to be placed within the many black communities set up by the UN, so that black people can then vote and see whether they want to stay a part of this country or not. We are a culture within ourselves. We are a nation within ourselves, and we have the right to claim nationhood. We say that the capitalistic system hasn't ever been able to employ all of its people. So therefore, we're demanding a change in the government system. And if black people decide, we're demanding land so that we will be an independent country. But this will be up to the bulk of black people through the vote, and the UN will supervise this vote. But as far as where do we start, we start with first revolutionizing or changing the American institutions.
Yes. Now, into the revolution, you think this is the start of a revolution, a full-scale revolution?
I think that before all full-scale revolutions, there are many votes that are somewhat unsuccessful, because if they were successful, then there would be a revolution. And now that with the resistance that occurred in Detroit and Newark and Los Angeles and in Oakland, that we're seeing that black people are along the road are going towards liberation. And I would predict that a full revolution will occur in this country if there's no immediate change of the government structure, which I doubt that, that this country is mature enough to revolutionize itself without bloodshed.
How can we get, say, the bourgeois black or the middle-class black who is enjoying certain privileges of the white man, and he believes now this privilege deserves him and he's trying to get more. How can we let him know that there's a revolution, that he should, how will he be able to do that?
Well, of course, the black bourgeoisie are the hand-picked leaders picked by the power structure to lead black people. Black people are now losing confidence in the black bourgeoisie simply because the black bourgeoisie has not led us to liberation. So the first step is for the black lower classes to reject the traditional leadership of the black bourgeoisie. And this is happening because, as you very well know, the black bourgeoisie has not endorsed the rebellions throughout the country, but yet the rebellions have occurred. So it's very clear that there is a tremendous gap between the masses of the lower class, which compose about 95% of black people in America, and the black bourgeoisie, who might compose 3% at the most, and that would be overestimating, I would say.
Would you say, you're very young, about 23, 24, right?
26.
Would you say that the younger generation are getting away from the bourgeois power? Would you say they're more coming toward your thinking? So it's like the old versus the young, and the young people are springing up a new kind of thinking.
I think the revolution has always been initiated by the young. Simply because the older people can see perhaps some change because they've lived a number of years and they see a change from, say, 50 years ago up to now. And the younger generation hasn't seen these changes at all. And I think that this is one of the reasons that in every country the young generation, the younger generation, lead the revolution, but some very conscious older people do identify with the revolution. And this is, I think this is universal.
Dewey, I saw you in court the other morning, and while some things were being said, and I was thinking, what do you feel about sitting in court being judged by the people that the revolution that you're fighting is against? How we feel? Tell me.
I feel very very little different than I feel just being free on having so-called freedom on the streets of white America. There you have in the so-called freedom you have complete you're completely controlled by a white establishment, a white racist establishment, and the court system is simply a part of this institution, this racist institution that's oppressing all black people throughout racist America. And that as far as the justice, I see very little justice that a black man can possibly get within the court system as it exists. And the black community is now standing up and demanding a revolutionary change within the court system.
Tell me, if you were in a position to predict your future, what would you say it would be like?
That's a very difficult question. But I have all faith in the people, in the black community, and I have very good counsel, and I have hope that change will come very soon, so that the court will be modified, so that black people will get justice all over this country. But it will be very difficult for me to say exactly what will, or even predict what will be the outcome.
Your environment here in the jail, could you say what it does for you in terms of your strength in your ideas and just the people that you're surrounded with? What it does, could you explain that?
Well, at this point, and I think that I won't be resigned now or in the future, that my beliefs are as strong or even stronger as they were before this incident. I remember when I used to go to church and Sunday school, the minister would say often that suffering is good for the soul, that it makes one stronger. So I think that I've experienced this here in jail, because the punishment seems to make a black man stronger, and that's one of the difficulties that the whole penal institution has with black people, that when they imprison a black man, that rehabilitation, as they call it, doesn't work really, because black people realize that they're political prisoners and that they're oppressed in the prisons just as they are in the so-called free world. And that all it does is makes one more hostile towards the oppressor.
Huey, it was interesting that we were talking the other day, and somebody went by, a young man like yourself went by, and you know him, you grew up together. Now, this man wasn't a militant, he wasn't considered a militant, but he was still here, he was still had the handcuffs on, he was still in jail. Could you explain the significance of that?
Well,
he wasn't really fighting a black militant thing as you're doing, a revolution, but yet he was still here with you.
Well, I would say that he's fighting a, thank you, he's fighting a black thing. He's fighting for a black cause, but perhaps he's not conscious of it. Many black brothers here in jail are in jail for robbery, for burglary, and so forth, and I view them as political prisoners, because the first thing is an injustice for them to be here, because I can't see where a man can rob or take what's already his. one thing that I would like to say to the revolutionary youth throughout this country and throughout the world, that the responsibility for the change is upon our shoulders. The older generation has proven that they have either been disinterested or unable to change the institutions that have caused murder throughout the world, and America being the monster at the head of the monster to create the disturbance all over the world. So it's going to be our job to revolutionize the world. As far as we're concerned, that we're advocates of the abolition of war. We do not want war, but war can only be abolished through war. And in order to get rid of the gun, we found it necessary to take up the gun. That's from Chairman Mao, and I think that most revolutionaries agree with this throughout the world. I think that change will only come through struggle. And of course, as I pointed out, and I recapitulate, that we don't want war, but if it's necessary for us to wipe war out with some strong tactics, we're prepared to do this.
We're doing now! We're doing now! We're doing now!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. You're just listening to an interview with Huey P. Newton entitled Prelude to Revolution, which James Baldwin himself conducted with Huey P. Newton while Huey P. Newton was in jail awaiting trial. So we're going to continue with our discussion of the Black